Well, let's take a moment together and return to your atmosphere. Get yourself consciously collected and concentrated, calm, within the 3 feet surrounding you. As we all know, ideas are one of the major culprits growing us outside of ourselves. They're like carbohydrates to the Western-trained mind. And so as we work today through this morning's second breakfast, let's return... If you can notice when your inner state is getting destabilized, unbalanced, when you're getting a little too far out of your own atmosphere with all the excitement of new concepts and things like that, if there are any, but come back quietly and see what happens when you receive ideas in a quiet mind. Not all excited by the stuff itself. So, yesterday we took a long slog through the whole subject of levels of consciousness, Teilhard's understanding of consciousness, some of the light shined on the cracks and blind spots in Teilhard's vision of consciousness, through the lens of contemporary levels of consciousness teaching, and how this teaching itself has some fairly significant blind spots. So we explored all that ground. When we come to Gurdjieff, it all becomes much easier. It's a simple yes and no question, and the answer is no. Zero raised to a higher power is still zero. And the classic Gurdjieffian take in one sentence is the ludicrousness of the situation is that we actually, as we are, as we find ourselves, as we work, we are unconscious. To the question of what level of consciousness are you at? Sorry, you're not on the scale yet. And that this could be merely ludicrous were it not for the fact that we think we are. And in that utterly false attribution to ourselves of something that we do not possess, we do incalculable damage on ourselves, our fellow sentient beings, and our planet itself. That it is possible to awaken that different states of consciousness are, in fact, possible for human beings, and in fact are requisite of human beings. Because when we fail to at least get on the scale of what human beings are actually called upon to do, we devolve. We fall to the consciousness that belongs properly to a lower order of being, and we fail to play the part that is actually required for us in the cosmic exchange, which requires us, if we're going to really get on board as helpers, as servants, as conscious servants, as we like to think of it, to start by being conscious. So Gurdjieff's teaching is all about levels of consciousness. He's got virtually no interest in the substance ontology of consciousness. If you're a very determined nerd and want to pick through the surfaces of the Food Factory and some of the wonderfully delicious teaching in Beelzebub, you can find that he actually throws you some pretty interesting hints about what consciousness consists of. But this is at any point not the major thrust of his work. The thrust of his work is practical. That if he came with any charge, any mission to the West, and it seems fairly clear that he was dispatched, that part of the price that he paid for his initiation in the long search was that he realized that the mission was going to be to go to the most confused and godforsaken corner of the earth, i.e. Europe, and there take people that were so reified in their illusion of consciousness that they were almost impenetrable, and try to wake them up to the fact that what they were doing was just a massive kind of amnesia. And then to begin to lay down beginning pathways by which they might come to some truer and more realistic and helpful sense of themselves. So it was mission impossible. It was first and foremost a deconstruction mission, and second, a reconstruction. And I think that you could, you know, see the work working on both of these issues. And when Gurdjieff came to writing, when he gave up in some sense on doing things in real group situations, his writings were collected in what he called his three series. And the first series, which is Beelzebub's Tales, basically, as he says it, to mercilessly deconstruct the fallacious view that people have of themselves and their noble and enlightened lineage. And then only then in the second and third series to begin to build a more solid foundation. So that's the program altogether, and you know, your staying power in the work, whether you like it or not, you know, whether you stick with this stream and whether you go anywhere in it, really depends, I think, for a lot of people on the first hurdle. If you prefer to believe you're conscious already and that you have this by way of the anatomy of your brain, the degree of your education, you know, I have Harvard and PhD after my name, I must be conscious. You know, if you proceed to continue in that way, the work is going to be repulsive. It's like holding a mirror before you when you don't want to see something. And it's easier to smash the mirror than to fix yourself. So the first part of it is really, the capacity to say, yeah, he's naming an inconvenient truth, but he's naming it. And as long as it's not named, I mean, can I continue to spin around like a top? So that's the first part. The second part, then, is to take what seems like a cumbersome and not always clear pedagogy with a lot of reading, with a lot of breathing, with a lot of moving attention around in sort of random ways, and with doing a lot of things that don't feel very religious or mystical or like states, and having a willingness to be led to the point where you can actually see that this is going somewhere. And then you have to, by the way, fend off all the shadow side of the work itself, which is the tendency to get very rigid and judgmental and closed in its transmission patterns, in the sense that the others out there definitely don't have being. So a being can only be carefully cultivated. I don't think anyone in the work has probably heard of the laborers in the vineyard parable. Certainly not in the foundation group. Can you ever enter at the 11th hour and still hope for salvation? We won't go there now. So for Gurdjieff, there are basically four levels of consciousness. His is all about a map of levels of consciousness, and they have really only a roughest correlation with what you may know if you've read the Ken Wilber maps and looked at the classic language of the Vedantic traditions about the gross level, the subtle level, the causal level, and the non-dual level. You can read all that in if you want, but when you do that, you're taking yourself away from yourself. That for Gurdjieff, there were basically four operational levels that you had to pay attention to, and they are sleep, waking sleep, otherwise known as ordinary consciousness, self-remembering, and objective consciousness. And the trick is to get from here to there. So the initial run-through of this gets laid out in Search of the Miraculous. And it's very clear, even if you read In Search of the Miraculous alertly, but particularly as you read it alertly in light of the scholarship that's begun to emerge and some of the very good writing in the later years about the unfolding of Gurdjieff's own teaching, that Gurdjieff did this in two stages. And the early stage, the Uspensky stage, he burst onto the screen in Russia, right at the gateway to World War I, with this remarkable teaching. And it was much tidier, much more systematic in its original iteration. All the parts were in order. It had maps, it had schematics, it had chemical analogies. He really thought it through so that it would match a European mind. And he met the perfect European mind in P.D. Uspensky, that he picked up as one of his earliest students, who had a mind to match his. And Uspensky was, at that point, already a well-known and highly credible philosopher. His great book, The Tertium Organum, had been recently published. He was wonderful. And the first meeting of Gurdjieff and Uspensky was somewhat akin to Rumi meeting Shamsi Tabriz. And the first thing Shams does is to take his manuscript, Rumi's manuscript of all his scholarly faults, and throw him down a well. It's like an upending, in some way, of everything that Uspensky has seen up to this point. But Uspensky was picked up for a reason. because he was a very, very powerful and coherent, unusually clear thinker, and therefore was able to package the work and present the work in a way that was far tidier and more coherent. He had a bent towards systematic metaphysics, which Gurdjieff never had. And therefore, he was able to clothe it in a patina which theoretically would be more accessible. And he went on and taught in his own right. He did grow extraordinarily. And his book, In Search of the Miraculous, is still the gateway. So he recalls, and he's capable to an extent of being able to look at himself with a sort of wry objectivity. He goes there and then he bounces back again. But one of their first meetings on which Gurdjieff begins to explore this subject is right early on in Search of the Miraculous. And I thought, since we already have the precedent started of reading from Beelzebub, that it wouldn't hurt to read a little from this, because it's very, very funny in its own way, this first encounter. So the way he begins to meet and court Uspensky, as it were, is in a series they would go out for coffee and have interesting discussions. And at one point, Uspensky is lamenting about the increased mechanization of Europe and how this runs the risk of turning people into machines. You know, it's sort of like the late 19th century take on, oh, the children are spending all their time on the internet. You know, they're losing the capacity. We each have our own version in every age of the fear that proximity to machines is contagious and will turn us into machines. And Gurdjieff, you know, so Uspensky was holding forth on this about how people are turning into machines, I said. And no doubt they become perfect machines, but I do not believe they can think. And so Gurdjieff just so says, "Ah, forget it, bud. You know, you'll being next to a machine isn't going to turn you into a machine." But then he goes on. He says, "The mechanism," says Gurdjieff, "you speak of is not at all dangerous. A man may be a man," he emphasized this word, "while working with machines. There is another kind of mechanization which is much more dangerous, being a machine oneself." "Have you thought about the fact that all people themselves are machines?" "Yes," I said, I being Uspensky. "From the strictly scientific point of view, all people are machines governed by external influences. But the question is, can the scientific point of view be wholly accepted?" "Scientific or not scientific, it's all the same to me," said G. "I want you to understand what I am saying. Look, all those people you see," he pointed along the street, "are simply machines, nothing more." "I think I understand what you mean," I said, "and I have often thought how little there is in the world that can stand against this form of mechanization and choose its own path." "This is just where you make your greatest mistake," said G. "You think there is something that chooses its own path, something that can stand against mechanization. You think that not everything is equally mechanical." "Why, of course not," I said. "Art, poetry, thought are phenomena of quite a different order." "Of exactly the same order," said G. "These activities are just as mechanical as everything else. Men are machines, and nothing but mechanical actions can be expected of machines." "Very well," I said. "But are there no people who are not machines?" "It may be that there are," said G, "only not those people you see, and you do not know them. That is what I want you to understand." I thought it rather strange that he should be so insistent on this point. What he said seemed to be obvious and uncontestable. At the same time, I never liked such short and all-embracing metaphors. They always omitted points of difference. What kind of a mind is that, folks? I, on the other hand, have always maintained differences were the most important thing, and that in order to understand things, it was at first necessary to see the points in which they differed. What part of perspectival thinking do you not understand? So I felt that it was odd that G insisted on an idea which seemed to be obvious provided it were not made too absolute and exceptions were admitted. People are so unlike one another, I said. I do not think it would be possible to bring them all under the same heading. Categorization, ratio. What part of perspectival thinking do you not think? Do you not understand? There are savages. There are mechanized people. There are intellectual people. There are amber. There are green. There are red. There are blue. There are geniuses. Quite right, said G. People are very unlike one another, but the real difference between people you do not know and cannot see. The difference of which you speak simply does not exist. This must be understood. All the people you see, all the people you know, all the people that you may get to know are machines. Actual machines working slowly and solely under the power of external influences. As you yourself said, machines they are born and machines they die. How do savages and intellectuals come into this? Even now, at this very moment while we are talking, several millions of machines are trying to annihilate one another. What is the difference between them? Where are the savages and where are the intellectuals? They are all alike. But there is a possibility of ceasing to be a machine. It is of this we must think, and not of the different kinds of machines we see. Of course there are different machines. A motor car is a machine, a gramophone is a machine, and a gun is a machine. But what of it? It is the same thing. They are all machines. What a conversation. I don't know what part of it I enjoy more. I think that what I really love is to watch all these dodges that Uspensky makes. You know, supremely confident in the education, the personality that's come to him from his era, relying on his acutely honed psychophilosophical maps to justify the fact that he and all these people or culture are not machines. Don't you smell the same thing if you live in a blue silo? Oh, yeah, totally. How can these primitives be duped by Trump? You hear the scorn dripping from that? How can a washing machine, you know, be at the same level as a gun? But it's that arrogance to think that because you have more cultural sophistication, more self-awareness in a way that actually in the Gurdjieff work is anti-self-awareness, is an elaborate exercise in self-delusion. I'll be at that shortly. You think that because of that you're more cultured? And you have the right to judge the motivation and the level of being of a geyser erupting out of a mythic structure of consciousness which has been neglected and repressed in our society for 500 years. You think you have even the beginning of a capacity to understand that, pass judgment on it, have an opinion on it? It's, you know, it's the blind leading the blind. So, for Gurdjieff, sleep, of course, what we've been half our life doing. And he did not dwell much in his teaching on the whole place that Jung was going to take it, to all the kind of prompts from our inner spirit guides that might come while we were in a state of sleep. It was just the baseline for him, sleep. But what was interesting for him is that when we wake up, we simply can do that same, what unites us to the state of actually being flat out horizontal on our pillow is greater than what divides it from us. When the alarm clock rings, we grab our cup of coffee and soldier off to meditation. So, again, reading from the exposition of this in Uspensky, Gurdjieff says, it's even worse because in sleep he is passive. That is, he cannot do anything. You know, you're confined on your bed and you can dream that you're ruling the world or a serial murderer, but, you know, the world remains somehow protected from your subjectivity. In the waking state, however, he can do something all the time, and the results of all his actions will be reflected upon him or upon those around him. And yet, he does not remember himself. He is a machine. Everything with him happens. He cannot stop the flow of his thoughts. He cannot control his imagination, his emotions, his attention. He lives in a subjective world of I love, I do not love, I like, I do not like, I want, I do not want. That is, of what he thinks he likes, of what he thinks he does not like, of what he thinks he wants, of what he thinks he does not want. He does not see the real world. The real world is hidden from him by the wall of imagination. He lives in sleep. He is asleep. What is called clear conscience is sleep, and a far more dangerous sleep than sleep at night in bed. You know, which is essentially the terror of the situation. If we had the humility to realize that we live as much in a dream when we wake up as we do when we are physically asleep, we would begin, perhaps, to get intrigued by the nature of our self-imprisonment. But because we're so firmly in the grasp of the goodies that seem to come to us from this self-imprisonment, we don't get out. I mean, Woody Allen nailed that in one of Woody Allen's absolute magnificent one-liners, which is probably the Gurdjieff work in one sentence. You know, and he's complaining to his psychiatrist, my brother, I got to do something about my brother. He thinks he's a chicken. And the psychiatrist says, well, why don't you work with him? Why don't you wake him up? I need the eggs. I think that's actually about the most brilliant line. That we all need the eggs. And what we get out of this massive delusion is the only source of energetic feeding we know. You know, that attraction aversion, which directs motivation in the lower orders, and is basically the programming of the machine system, propels us toward things that are pleasurable to us and away from things that are not pleasurable. And what this really is a feeding system for our psyche. The reason we go towards things that are pleasurable is because it fills us with this sense of enlightenment, with this sense of being. It feeds us. And sometimes weirdly psychotic things can feed us. Sometimes masochism feeds you. Those of you who have worked with the Enneagram of Personality, you know, the classic, almost archetypal configuration of this is the personality type 2 that's forever putting itself out, getting involved in other people's dramas, you know, taking on the next waif or the next homeless, waking up to respond to the 3 a.m. phone call if you're a pastor of a church, you know, just sacrificially putting yourself out there to be dismembered, broken for you, like a little baby Eucharist. Why do you do it? What are your eggs? And you don't want to see your eggs. You say, oh, Christ has called me to this. You know, hell, the eggs are that you're indispensable. And in a world where your terror is that you don't belong and that these people are going to reject you if they find out who you really are, by making yourself indispensable, by making yourself loved, you get the egg you really need. And you're willing to pay the price of the consistent omelets of your higher consciousness in order to get the egg you really need. We don't want to see that. And in point of fact, we can't see that without long training. This is Gurdjieff's exact point. So it's really only at a point where you come to that place where something in you begins to see that. And it can come in a variety of different ways. By the long route of frustration, or the short route of a lightning bolt of conscience. But something dislodges you. You look at your life 40 years later and say, why am I still going around in the same circles? Or some event completely upends you, be it a sickness, a departure of a beloved, a reversal of fortunes, and the shock waves that roll through your system, and the grief and the remorse, a word I'll be back to, are so great that in one shaft you see rather than deduce the utter fallacy of what you've been living. You no longer need the egg. The price is not worth it. And you yearn for the freedom that lies beyond it. Sometimes it's just the curiosity. Gurdjieff has a mordant tale somewhere about the shepherd, the lazy shepherd, who was really tired of having to take care of his sheep all the time. You know, he didn't want to just have to spend all his nights sleeping next to the sheep. He wanted them to stay inside the pen. So he simply hypnotized the sheep. And he told them, you are the finest sheep. This place is your paradise. You are at home here. You are being fulfilled. And perfectly docilely, they bought the electric fence around their freedom. And he could go to the pub every night. He would not wander because they were safely and securely marooned, tethered within their illusion. There it is. So when that moment dawns on one with sufficient force, so that it's not just an interesting idea that you think about when you come to Claymont for a few days, and then you go home and think about other things. But it remains a worm boring in your entrails. Then something becomes possible. And we move into this opening of this third state, which Gurdjieff calls self-remembered. And I want to talk about this very gently and try to remember who I'm not as I talk about it. That it's one of those, I think I could say, holy ideals within the work. I heard it, remember yourself, remember yourself, remember yourself. But what does it mean to remember yourself? And it's a state in which you're simultaneously aware not only of the experience itself that you or that it, the egg seeker, is involved in, but you are also simultaneously taking in from a whole different level the sense that I am here at the moment you're experiencing it. So it's a sort of doubled or expanded awareness that can pay attention not only to the subject, or not only to the object of reflection, but to the subject. I am here in the midst of this. And it's the glimmers of this kind of consciousness that set the foundation for a potentially different outcome. The reason I want to talk about it generally is I was just thinking, well, the best thing to do for me would be to sort of set this up so we had a conversation here, and I asked some of the people experienced in the work about, well, what does self-remembering mean to you? What does self-remembering mean to you? And then I happened to pick up Nichols' commentary last night, and he had a section that fell open before me about progress of the work, and it says that you know that a student is making progress when he doesn't ask dumb questions like, what does self-remembering mean? Again, that skew. You know, a Spencer truly been an opposite, truly been an artist and poet, so let's get the definition better. So what could be more linear than to start with a definition of self-remembering, judiciously hiding and feigning humility to those senior in the work than I? What part of deceit do you not understand? So I figured it would finally be more honest to just talk about little refractions of the experience from my own experience and encourage the inquiry in your own, and then contribute the one piece that is really on my plate this time to contribute, which is, like Ouspensky, to make some differences. So I remember very vividly the first time this happened to me. It was like in my own life, the moment I was born, really born. And I don't remember all the details, but the impression is so vivid that it stays with me 70 years later. That it was in the fall, it must have been around Halloween, it must have been around this week, because the fields out in Pennsylvania, Dutch country, in Pennsylvania where I lived, were filled with pumpkins. And I was about 3 1/2, and the sunset was just touching, and the sky was orange, and the pumpkins were orange, and the sun was orange, and everything glowed with this incredible orange roundness. And the air was the air the way the air is when the heat of the sun goes at it, out of it in sunset, and all of a sudden you're just braced with, you know, that first presence of chill. And I said, I'm experiencing this. I'm here, I said. And there was such a shock that I've just told you from 70 years ago, really vivid details. How many sunsets and sunrises and pumpkins have I seen since that time? But that moment, because it was coupled with my deep awareness that I am here, exists at a different level of
of vibrancy, intensity, reality within me, I was awake at that moment. And I know that the awakeness had something to do with that state of expanded awareness of, I know I'm here. I was 3.5. About a year later, I had the bookend experience to that, where, and I remember that one vividly too, that my mom had gone out Saturday afternoon, rainy Saturday afternoon. She'd gone out shopping or something. My daddy was holding down the fort with me and my little brother, and they were playing trains, you know, and I was sitting up, you know, I was sitting in my room. And also, all of a sudden, it occurred to me, you know, I saw that I was going to die. And it was just like, I felt very, very strongly that this incredible conscious viewing platform that I'd just been giving was going to end. And it wasn't like I was afraid of dying of some disease or something like that. It's just like something in me saw around the end of my finite life itself. And I was filled with this incredible sense of pity that how could this be done to a creature to be given this precious moment of self-reflective awareness, of conscious participation, only to have it pulled out from under you. And I was so overwhelmed by this and shaken by this that I went in. Of course, you go to your father for protection. And I said, Daddy, Daddy, I'm going to die. And I remember to this day the look that crossed his eyes, that there was this stricken horror. He, whose own mother had died when he was 18. Stricken horror. And then you could see something kind of get its ground in him, and his eyes sort of turned serpentine and sleaze bagged over, and a parental smile came on his face, and he goes, no, you're daddy's little girl and I'll take care of you. And I remember thinking that the 5-year-old equivalent of, oh shit, this is worse than I thought. Not only am I going to die, but they're going to lie about it for the rest of their life. <You know? laughs> And in that moment, my trust in the stereotypes died forever. I realized that part of the parcel of being born into this planet was this massive collusion about both its finitude and its true nature. So how do you know this when you're 5? You don't know it. You see. For a moment you see, and then the seeing closes again. So the big difficulty that people have understanding this whole self-remembering thing from the outside is that from the outside, with the mind that we bring, the Aspensky mind that we've just been relishing and poking fun at, skewed to differences. We can't see the difference between self-remembering and its simulacrum in what we call today self-reflection or self-awareness. It looks like standing outside yourself and reflecting on yourself from third person. And a person who is self-aware in the psychological parlance of our day is one who's reflected deeply on their life, often with the help of a spiritual guide or a counselor or a psychotherapist, knows the story of their life, knows the deformations and the tragedies that shaped them in the way they are. You know, I could go on in my little story I just shared with you and said, and that was the beginning of me as radical subversive because, you know, when I found my father wasn't trustworthy, you know. Yeah. Oh yeah, she's off and running again. You know? Without noticing that what had happened was that a state of aliveness had just gone stale. and nobody noticed its departure. But yeah, so we take introspection. We tend to think in our not yet conscious mode of being, that self-reflection and self-remembering has something to do with getting the narrative of ourself correct, with journaling, with dream work, with soul work, as it's called. And we don't understand that it's all going on within one of the teacups, the teacup of the mind. It's a construction. And since we don't see it, and since we are so trapped within these modalities and these categories, even more so today than in Gurdjieff's era, because back in Gurdjieff's era, it was still sort of open turf. Freud and Jung and psychotherapy were all still just beginning to make their way against the grain of received spiritual traditions, which carried a much more powerful vision of what an awake and whole person was. Nowadays, we're way, 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 way down the path. And, that we have hierophants that actually intone to us in different language, man is a machine. You do the Enneagram of Personality work, and you get that printout. You know, you put your type in, you find out, and you find out what your machinality is. Yeah, if you're a two, you're going to act out this way. If you're a three, you're going to act out this way. You know, buying the fact that it is a machine and that we need to learn to manage it by looking in the past for the source of its deformations and then moving forward. So self-reflective, self-remembering means in the flat horizon of perspectival thinking to have an accurate story of yourself. Whereas the precise ingredient of the kind of self-remembering that Gurdjieff is talking about is for a moment being shed of your story. Being done with it altogether. And stepping out into the fresh, virgin freefall of who am I? Beatrice Bruto followed this very, very brilliantly as a student of Teilhard and also as a student and teacher of the Vedanta tradition. And in one of the early pieces she wrote way back in the 1980s, Prayer and Identity, she had a line that just grabbed me, where she took on right directly our tendency, this well-programmed into us tendency in Western society, to conflate self-awareness in the narrative sense and self-reflection by standing out and looking down on yourself with this other. And she said what she's talking about is something really deeper than just going over the list of our characteristics, our histories, our Bibles. She says, you are to coincide subjectively with the act of being present, not to reflect on your presence or your being. To coincide subjectively. And I know that may not come clear yet, but see if you can. There's some part of you that will catch the difference. You know, it has something to do with not extending this subject-object pole. You know, not that, oh, that's Benjamin over there. But somehow just rather than say, oh, that's him, that's the actor, and I'm pulling the strings of it, to be one, to collect yourself at the subjective pole. And I don't mean subjective in the sense of individual, introspective, but subjective in the sense of who you were before consciousness bifurcated and split into its subject-object arrangement. draw yourself deeply back in. The text for today, suck in your atmosphere. Conserve yourself within your atmosphere. Return to the original oneness where you vibrate as a whole. Be the eyes you are looking through. Something in that direction. She clarified it a little bit later in a extended passage that I quoted when I was working with Teilhard in a recent book, talking about, there's a chapter in God's Ecstasy, the next to the last one, called Pathways to Consciousness, where she makes a distinction between these two modes of consciousness, and self-reflection following that program will immediately go to defining characteristics, differentiation, etc. She says, Brute clarifies the distinction between these two modes of perception. In contrast to the dualistic levels of consciousness, which tend to establish identity through its description, the set of characteristics that define it by differentiating it from others in that same category, non-dual consciousness, or mystical, or what we might call aperceptible, as she calls it here, and here's the quote, is the immediacy and irreducibility of a subjective experience of knowing by being instead of by representing. The object of consciousness is in this case the subject itself. When the subject is aware of the subject, not by reflection, that is, not by making a representation of the subject or the act of being conscious or the concept of being the knower, but the subject is aware of the subject by being aware as subject. Aware as subject of subject by being subject in a fully luminous, not unaware or unconscious way. That consciousness is mystical. Self-remembering has something to do with the collapse of that subject-object pole which defines ordinary consciousness, making it always insistent on translating itself into the narrative of itself, bound in linearity and time, and being able to step at the subject pole into the full immediacy and vibrancy of your being. And surprisingly, something is aware there. That even, you know, we tend to think that consciousness can only be explored, can only be experienced in that subject-object distinction. What's there to be realized is that's precisely the place where it can't be experienced. That's what results in sleep. That's what results in the Mercator projection of your own past history as your life. That there's something that becomes aware of that. And I really like the drift that's going up into talking about it as an expanded attention. Because the efforts and the work that, as it was originally presented, trying to find a way to make this somehow conceivable to a dichotomous mind, was to say, well, keep a little bit of you in reserve to remember your being while you're doing your activity. But you can't do it in that configuration. It further splits the field and exhausts you. It's like, as in movements, which really is the kind of, you know, experiential entree to everything, you have to find a place where you can hold the whole thing. You know, feet, hands, and head, and intention can be held from a single place, but not a place that exists in the mind. But a place that exists in the body. It's not like, I have to rely on grace for it to come, you know. That's a subjective, you know, experience of the overwhelmed mind. It exists in the body. It exists lower down in the body and in a different balance of the body. What we're actually saying is that it is a different structure of perception which will engage, that can be conscious apart from the subject-object field, the dichotomy. That simply is the way we do it in waking sleep. And it can wake up and it can allow us to move within ourself from an instantaneous coming from within, knowing and seeing, which is a without thinking. Because thinking is slow. But we can't do that in the normal state because of our unbalanced and lopsided and almost pathological dependence on one particular center to generate our sense of selfhood. I'll be back to that in a minute. That's exactly the problem that the work is trying in its own way to fix. Anyway, as to objective consciousness, I can't say much, except that it is attainable. It's the capacity to see beyond our own perspective, our own slice, and to see in a deeper way from the whole. You know, to see in multi-dimension at once, so that it brings an impartiality. But real objective seeing can't be attained even by the wisest perfection of the intellect. The intellect, it simply overrides the capacity of the intellect to do it. Even by being enormously learned and compassionate in your nature, you can get a bit of the ways, but you won't have objective seeing. It's a sense of the whole situation. I believe, and I'm not prepared to commit myself to this 100%, but it's gathering in me that Gurdjieff taught that the gate can be entered, but it must be entered through the gateway of conscience. And we're going to talk about that more Thursday and Friday. But our normal routes of just becoming more tolerant, more broad-minded, aren't going to do it. Objective seeing is seeing as our common father sees. And it can't be seen apart from the tears by which our common father sees. And as we try to do it with our highest qualities, we stumble and fail. But it can be seen. Teilhard was working that way. He had an intuition toward that. I'm going to come back to that when we talk more about Teilhard tomorrow morning. He had an intuition, but again, the language and the cultural tools of his time and the very fact of his education essentially created a roadblock to his intuitive knowing. Always the risk. But that's about all I would want to say about objective knowing. Don't give up hope on it. It comes to all of us generally as a lightning shaft for a while. Moments that you never forget. Moments you certainly can't have. But you know it's there. And in the moments that you know it's there, you know that we live in a compassionate, coherent universe, which nothing can fall out of. And beyond that, there's no fear. There's no particular excitation. There's no anticipation. There's no breathlessness. Just is. Just is. So the second part of this, which, because we're doing it all week, I can do briefly, relatively briefly, I can sort of summarize it and then we can live it out in blood, sweat, and tears in the kitchen on the movement floor and then trying to get the candles out of the tree. So what Gurdjieff brought, and the harder part of the assignment in a way, is that once you awaken people to this horror that their great civilization and their great cultural sophistication of which they're so proud is just glorified sleep, enlightened sleep, if even enlightened. What do you do to wake them up? And out of that fell the technology of transformation in the work. And many, many, many religious traditions, all traditions with an inner understanding, say essentially the same thing that Gurdjieff is saying. It's not rocket science. In Vedanta, you call it illusion. In Sufism, you call it gofle, unawareness. It's there. My Sufi teacher once told this wonderful story about a dream his teacher told him. About they went to this cemetery, and the teacher told him to read the headstones. And it said, Fatima, 3 years, 2 days. Hussein, 27 minutes. Suleiman, 2 years. And he looked at his teacher and it said, this is a children's cemetery. And his teacher says, no, it measures the time in their life they were actually awake. Go flit. Living our life in unawareness. So the traditions all know this. But what Gurdjieff brought to this was that it wasn't simply a matter of ripping the veil off of your eyes and all of a sudden seeing. You know, the mu moments so prized in the Buddhist tradition are in fact rare, and if we ever get them at all, we can't sustain them. Because Gurdjieff's teaching on the actual technology of transformation is dependent on his concept, his notion of pre-centered awareness. That is that we have in our being, as three brain beings, three discrete and clear systems of intelligence. Moving center, which senses, emotional center, which feels, intellectual center, which thinks and cognizes. They each have their legitimate function. There are actually two more, the instinctive and the sexual center, which began to figure more prominently as his teaching developed. But in the classic model, the three that actually we have the possibility of having some relationship to, moving center, thinking center or intellectual center, emotional center, feeling. And for Gurdjieff, these centers exist, but they're hopelessly out of balance and not in communication with each other. Now, also accessible to us, part of our trousseau as human beings, part of our birthright and part of our obligation, is that we have free access to two higher centers, higher emotional center and higher intellectual center, from which emerge the stuff that gets us out of the loop there of waking sleep, that can flood our being with a different order of intensity, with a different order of clarity, with a different order of compassion. We have complete access to these. They're right there. But the problem is we can't hold it. Because it requires the lower centers to be online and in balance to hold it. Otherwise, the higher centers overwhelm it, and you become moth to flame. This is classic mystical consciousness, which is ecstatic, which means it stands out of itself. It gets drawn to these higher things, takes one final orgiastic hit, and then dissolves into it. Ecstasy. Bring it on. And so it's only as we prepare the lower undercarriage that the lightning rod is placed, is activated, that allows us to begin to receive and ultimately to transmit this higher order of intensity. Only with this. And it really is, in a deep sense, simultaneous, because it's only in this little screwed up universe that we think you do something first and then something happens next. The balancing of the centers, the lower centers, is in and of itself simultaneously a clearing of a space for the activation of the higher centers. And just because you're getting direct hits, or you're not getting direct hits like you used to, doesn't mean it's not happening. It means that actually it's happening more smoothly, so you don't notice it. And this is progress. So it's there, you know, as T.S. Eliot says, we must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion. It's not like going somewhere else. It's like getting the lower order hooked up so that that which is ours, both by birthright and by obligation to transmit, can be safely and coherently transmitted without destroying us or those we touch. So the great wager for Gurdjieff is that if you can just get the lower centers in order, the rest will take care of itself. And we're going to try and fine-tune and clarify that. You don't have to go seeking for mystical experiences to jack yourself up in order to be convinced that this exists, thereby knocking yourself further and further out of balance. What he suggested is that we seek instancy, not ecstasy. That we learn how to stand in ourself, to stay inside our atmosphere. And to the extent that we learn to do that, our nervous systems will strengthen, as Murat Yagen, my Bektashi teacher, used to say, and we will be able to bear these beams of love far more responsibly than we do. So, the famous work story about the state of our lower centers is the image of the carriage and the driver. And it tells you a little bit about the times when this was written, which was, you know, that the motor car was just coming in. But he likened the usual state of our being to a bad hack, basically. You know, that the carriage is our body, the horse is our emotions, the driver is our intellectual center. And the carriage is in total disrepair. The horse is wild and out of control. It's got all this energy and it's got all this force, but it doesn't know how to move in a direction. The driver is off the seat and at the pub. And even if he does manage to stumble back and get up onto the box without killing himself, that there are no reins. That the intellectual center cannot communicate with the emotional center. You know, the driver can't communicate with the horse. And we know this is true in our life, don't you? You sit there and you say, well, this day I am definitely not going to do this, not going to do this, not going to do this. You look at yourself and 5 minutes later you've gone and done it. You know, it's like, how did that happen? It's because there are no reins. You know, the intellectual center doesn't talk the same language as the horse, the emotional center. We don't know how to communicate. If we're even on the box, we can't communicate with our equipment. We don't see the dysfunction of the carriage. It's a mess. And so Gurdjieff's analogy again is that if we can get the whole arrangement in order, the carriage in decent working order, the driver on the seat, the horse under some sort of conscious symbiotic interaction with the driver, then there is a chance that the master can occupy this carriage. And we move into the third state of consciousness. Somebody's actually home. So that's it. And to speak very, very simply about what we've actually been working at all week, you know, and kind of orderly linear mind that I have as a kind of specimen A of the deficient mental conscience in its last realms. That basically in the work and concentrated, particularly in the morning exercises, we work with some basic techniques that will allow us to begin to repair the damage, to begin to learn to be in other ways in this mess, so that the lower exoskeleton, the three centers, can come into more harmonious contact. And as I see it, there are four basic skills that you begin to learn in a concentrated way in the exercises, and then practice in various different combinations throughout the day in the various fields we're working with, in the practical work and the movements in the classes. The first is utilizing attention to arouse sensation in your body. Simply beginning to become in touch with the moving center, with the carriage that we basically take for granted. And when you're thinking and talking and, you know, being a talking head, you're not only not in your body, but you're in a very, very low energetic state still. So learning by inviting this mysterious power of your attention, placing it on an arm or a leg, to actually miraculously evoke sensation there, so that your whole body has the sense of being alivened, more physically present. It's an extraordinary gift. I missed that gift for years in my training in the work, because when we sat down to do morning exercises, I just got bored because I wanted to have quiet time so that I could float off into mystical outer space. And I never realized that the disciplined work of arousing sensation was exactly what I needed to avoid drifting off into outer space. The second thing that we begin to learn is to really begin to move attention in the body. You bring your attention to your right arm, to your left arm, to your left leg, the basic bodily rotation, so that you can begin to direct attention. And you start usually and typically with the outer limbs, and then begin to learn to work using the same methodology to reach the more inward. And sometimes good work teaching will have you make passes over your attention. We did this much in my group in Halifax, where when you brought your attention to your right arm, skin level, deeper muscle level, bone, how far deep down can you actually sense into something using the power of your attention? This is a very vital skill if you're going to begin to sense your heart and not default to thinking or visualizing or anything like that. But so beginning to move attention around the body to place it, you know, those of you who've worked a little bit with the four ideals to know what it means to draw in attention and then place it in your genitals, in your spine, in the region of your belly, in the region of your chest. And it's a movement. And to have attention sensation that much under control is a profound tool for being able to direct the force of your consecrated will in a way that can actually do something, both inwardly and outwardly. The third thing I think that's learned is the capacity, is the sense of what it means in all three centers do make strong. We worked on exercise 39, movement 39, yesterday. And I'm assuming that all of you had a taste as you went through the sort of slightly asymmetrical rotations of a body position, combined with really trying to do it through sensing, feeling, knowing, that they have subtly different reverberations, and that when all three of them are online, you've really made strong, and that there's a force of being that's now stabilized and can be called forth. So we work on them separately, like arms, legs, and head, and then put them together. And then finally, and most powerfully, the capacity to relate this to breath. Again, you see this in Make Strong. Can you do sensation so quickly and fully at some point? Can you get to a point where it can be taken in on the in-breath and then directed on the out-breath so that it joins the great breathing of the cosmos and is enhanced and vitalized by it? Not easy. But with these skills somewhat under your belt, you make the marvelous discovery that there is no belt. And free of the trappings, you begin to become able to unite higher and lower and actually do in the world with directed force, particularly if you can have the blessing to be joined with a group of your fellows who are working in the same way, with the same sincerity, to begin to create streams that by these practices, by these roots, are not just wish fulfillment. Let's all just get together and pray for peace in the world. Another useless carving in the great laboriousness of humankind, as Jacob Beard says. You've got to have some guts to it. There's an inner technology that's geared to the body. And I think what has made the work both so off-putting for some and so absolutely salvific for others is just that it won't let you off the hook here. You know, you got to daydream salvation too? You're going to daydream a peaceful universe while the whole thing is burning up around you? Or are you going to find your way back to the skills, the gifts and the obligations that were given to human beings at the level of human being to actually do something useful? So this is the query. And what makes it hard is there's such a long road to hoe. before we can be collected even for 5 minutes in our state, in ourselves. So the need to trust that something else meets us and doubles our efforts, I think is really important. And we're going to be looking for the rest of the week at the sense of where that might come from and what it might be for it in both Teilhard and Gurdjieff. But for now, that will do for a quick and dirty, you know, as Matt suggested on the first night, we need a book called Gurdjieff for Idiots. So much for Gurdjieff for Idiots. Let's return to our atmosphere. Now let's see if you can move out from right where you are now and actually get yourself to the next thing you're doing while still remaining in your atmosphere. We'll see you shortly.